Good morning and welcome. It is good to have everybody here. We're especially thankful for our visitors, and we hope you'll stick around a little bit afterwards so that we can get to know you. Really quickly, Ryan, can you hear me? Other words, Ryan, you can hear me? Okay. Didn't sound like the microphones were working too well this morning, but as long as you can hear me in the back, that's good. All right, go ahead and take out a Bible. You're going to need it this morning. We are going to go through and read a healthy chunk of the Old Testament. And I so wish that I had an encouraging message for you this morning, one that just filled with hope. Frankly, it's not. It's a depressing message to me. What we're going to do is we're going to continue the series on the temple. And you'll notice that we're going to talk about its demise this morning. And that's just not an encouraging message. It, in fact, is quite sad to see occur. So what we have observed up to this point is, by now, if you've been here for very long, you're familiar with just this quick chart, with Moses building a tabernacle, which is just a tent. And then later on, a few hundred years later, we have Solomon builds the permanent structure that is the temple, and it is a glorious structure. And it lasts for about 300 years until about 586, when it is destroyed by the Babylonians and the people go into captivity. And then when they come back from the captivity, they rebuild the temple. And then Jesus is the one who comes and later kicks the people out of the temple for not behaving properly. And then in 70 AD, the temple is destroyed. And what we've observed is that this temple that is described in the Old Testament is a shadow of something else. And in the New Testament, it is described really as a shadow of two things. One is heaven itself, and the other is the church. And so in the first two lessons, really what we have done is we've just talked in the first lesson about the concept itself of a temple and what it is. And then we're doing it, breaking it down into time periods. And you may not have noticed that last time, because last time we talked about building according to the pattern. And really we're talking about when Moses builds the tabernacle and Solomon builds the temple. And what we're going to talk about now is this time period right here that leads to the destruction. So really quickly, what we talked about last week was following the design. Before that, we talked about just the temple in general. And you need to understand this. You need to have this in mind for this particular lesson. The temple was not a church. It was not some building. It was the building. It was a building that when it was first built as a tent, the people couldn't go into it because God filled it. It was a building that when it was built by Solomon as this stone structure, it was not just some building that the priests could go into. They couldn't go in either because God filled it. It represented God in their midst, and that was everything. It meant that wherever they went, when it was a tabernacle, they could take God with them. He was always with them. If there was ever a problem, if there was ever a struggle, they could turn to the temple and they could call to God and He would be their hope and He would be their strength. It meant everything. It was a glorious thing to have this temple in their midst. It made the Jews truly unique. You can see a temple for Zeus all over the place. You could see a temple for the Baals all over the place. The various idols became just commonplace. They would have idols inside people's homes. You would have idols inside every gateway. Idols, those things were normal, but there was only one nation and only one temple to the Lord. It made them truly unique and special. This was a great thing for the people of Israel to have a temple. So when they went from the tabernacle to the temple, what happened was we went from this temporary tent. A tent is not a permanent home. It's so transient. You can pick it up and you can move it away. God could leave them at any point. They went from that to having this solid structure with a firm foundation in their midst, and it meant God is always with us. God will always be here and we can always turn to it. But God wanted them to remember it being built in stone didn't mean it would always stay there. So let's start off in 1 Kings chapter 9, verses 6 through 9. in which God reminds them at this dedication of the temple that it's important that they follow him. It says, "But if you or your sons indeed turn away from following me and do not keep my commandments and my statutes which I have set before you and go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land which I have given them, and the house which I have consecrated for my name I will cast out of my sight. So Israel will become a proverb and a byword among all peoples. And this house will become a heap of ruins. Everyone who passes by will be astonished and hiss and say, 'Why has the Lord done this to this land and to this house?' And they will say, 'Because they forsook the Lord their God, who brought their fathers out of the land of Egypt and adopted other gods and worshiped them and served them. Therefore the Lord has brought all this adversity on them.'" So here they're building this temple. They've got it built. They're dedicating it. And God gives them this reminder. He says, "I've dedicated it. I've consecrated it. This is my house. But you have to obey me or I'll take it away." Solomon is the one who built the temple, right? Solomon's there at this dedication. Solomon is one who hears these words. Solomon knows this. So certainly Solomon's going to treat the temple correctly. And this begins our sad look through history. As we look at how the kings then treat the temple from this point to the time of its demise. Indeed, what we're going to find out is that when God destroys the temple, he only treats it the way they had treated it up to that point. And that's a really sad thing. So we start off with Solomon, the one who built the temple, the one who'd been warned, "You got to follow me." And we go to 1 Kings chapter 11. It says, "Now King Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughters of Pharaoh, Moabite, and Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women, from the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the sons of Israel, 'You shall not associate with them, nor shall they associate with you, for they will surely turn your hearts away after their gods.' Solomon held fast to these in love. He had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned his heart away. For when Solomon was old, his wives turned his heart away after other gods. And his heart was not wholly devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the detestable idol of the Ammonites. Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and did not follow the Lord fully as David his father had done. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable idol of Moab, on the mountain which is east of Jerusalem, and for Molech, the detestable idol of the sons of Ammon. This also he did for all his foreign wives who burned incense and sacrificed to their gods." Now, you might read that and not think about it in regards to the temple, but that absolutely is about the temple. You see, up to that point, it was the temple. In all the land of Israel, this was the temple to God. And now, even within the city of Jerusalem, it is just a temple. Do you see what Solomon did there? He had built this great, glorious temple for God, and then he just went over another hill and he said, "And here's a temple for this God, and here's a temple for this God." He took it from being this great, holy, consecrated, makes us unique temple, and it just becomes a temple. And so what happens after that? Well, then we have Rehoboam. And Rehoboam receives a warning from God in 1 Kings chapter 14. Because he does basically the same thing. He makes it even more diluted as to the number of temples and holy places within the land of Israel. And so 1 Kings 14, verse 21, Rehoboam, by the way, is Solomon's son. 1 Kings 14, starting verse 21. "Now Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, reigned in Judah. Rehoboam was 41 years old when he became king, and he reigned 17 years in Jerusalem, the city which the Lord had chosen from all the tribes of Israel to put his name there. And his mother's name was Naamah the Ammonitess. Judah did evil in the sight of the Lord, and they provoked him to jealousy more than all that their fathers had done with the sins which they committed. For they also built for themselves high places and sacred pillars in Asherim on every high hill and beneath every luxuriant tree. There was also male cult prostitutes in the land. They did according to the abominations of the nations which the Lord dispossessed before the sons of Israel. Now notice what God does. Now it happened in the fifth year of the king Rehoboam that Shishak, the king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem, and he took away the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house, and he took everything, even taking all the shields of gold which Solomon had made. God had said, all right, so you have this temple. I'm going to take it if you don't obey. Solomon doesn't obey. His son doesn't obey. And so God says, all right, let me give you a little warning shot, a little hint of what's to come. Here comes the Egyptians. They come in. And he says, I'm going to let them loot your temple. Let me correct that. I'm going to let them loot my temple is what God's doing. So that's Rehoboam. Well, of course, Rehoboam actually is pretty mild in comparison to the other king that exists at this time. When Solomon dies, the kingdom divides, and you have the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, and the king of the north is Jeroboam. And 1 Kings chapter 12, verse 25 through 33 describes how when Jeroboam becomes king, he's fearful of the people going back to the house of David, but it's not just the house of David. He's afraid they're going to go back to the temple. He rejects the temple itself. He rejects God. So it says, then Jeroboam built Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim and lived there. And he went out from there and built Penuel. Jeroboam said in his heart, now the kingdom will return to the house of David. If this people go to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will return to their Lord, even to Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they will kill me and return to Rehoboam, king of Judah. So the king consulted and made two golden calves, and he said to them, it is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold your gods, O Israel, that brought you up out of the land of Egypt. He set one in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. Now this thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one as far as Dan. And he made houses on high places and made priests from among all the people who were not of the sons of Levi. Jeroboam instituted a feast in the eighth month on the 15th day of the month, like the feast which is in Judah. And he went up to the altar. This he did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves which he'd made. And he stationed in Bethel the priests of the high places which he had made. Then he went up to the altar which he had made in the Bethel on the 15th day in the eighth month, even on the month which he had devised in his own heart. And he instituted a feast for the sons of Israel and went up to the altar to burn incense. And so he's afraid they're going to go back to the temple. So what's he do? He says, well, alternatives, other temples, other places, other idols. We're going to have other things for you to worship. And so Jeroboam thus sets the northern kingdom on a track where the entire northern kingdom has turned its back on the temple and thus on God. Well, if you look at 2 Chronicles chapter 11, verses 14 through 17, we're not going to read that, but to their credit, there were people who just rejected that idea. They would not allow it. And so they did not follow Jeroboam, and they left and they went to the southern kingdom because they were going to follow the temple. So there are still some people who have this idea that says we are still going to follow God. And then in 2 Chronicles chapter 13, we have Rehoboam's son, Abijah. And Abijah goes to war against Jeroboam, and he's outnumbered. Jeroboam has twice the size of an army, and he comes up against Rehoboam. And Rehoboam says, you know what mistake you made? You rejected the temple, and we don't. We won't. We follow it. We serve it. And Jeroboam attacks anyway and loses more than half of his army as the people of Judah survive. And it is in that claim, if you were to read verses 8 through 12 especially, is when he calls claim to God, and not just God, but to the house, to the temple. Things only get worse from here. Okay, so 2 Chronicles 16, verses 1 through 4. Turn with me here. We get to Asa. In the 36th year of Asa's reign, Baasha, the king of Israel, came up against Judah and fortified Ramah in order to prevent anyone from going out or coming in to Asa, king of Judah. Then Asa brought out silver and gold from the treasuries of the house of the Lord and the king's house and sent them to Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, who lived in Damascus, saying, let there be a treaty between you and me as between my father and your father. Behold, I have seen your silver and I have sent you silver and gold. Go break your treaty with Baasha, king of Israel, so that he will withdraw from me. So Ben-Hadad listened to King Asa and sent the commanders of his armies against the cities of Israel, and they conquered Ijon, Dan, Ebal-Meam, and all the store cities of Naphtali. All right, so just a little mention there, but do you see what just happened? If you're familiar with the old law, then you're familiar with this. God had said to them, don't make covenants with other nations. You trust me, don't trust other nations. Here's what happened. The people of Judah were being, there was a siege being built around them. They get scared, so they do what you're supposed to do. You go to the temple. And you call on God, except for he didn't go to the temple and called on God. He went to the temple and he took the wealth from the temple to go call on someone else. Maybe people can save us, God can't, but we'll steal from God to give to someone else to save us. If you continue on in 2 Chronicles 16, God's kind of upset about that. He sends a prophet, and of course Asa gets upset about that and throws the prophet in prison. Well, then you have the sons of Athaliah. So later on in 2 Chronicles chapter 24, the king of Israel is killed, and the king's mother takes charge. And she really, the queen mother, tries to take control of the throne. She tries to kill all of those who are of the lineage who have the right to the throne. One little boy, a boy by the name of Joash, is saved. We'll get to him in a second. But here we have now this queen Athaliah, and she is in charge in Judah, and we find out about her children, what they're doing. In verse 7 it says, for the sons of the wicked Athaliah had broken into the house of God and even used the holy things of the house of the Lord for the Baals. So here's God's great temple and the great items within it, and now what are they being used for? Let's offer up to Baal a sacrifice on God's altar. Things are not looking good. Well, then there's Joash. Remember Joash, he's this little boy. The priest takes Joash and he brings him into the temple as this little baby to hide him from the evil queen Athaliah. Jehoiada is the priest, and he's a great man. And when Joash is 7 years old, the people revolt against Athaliah and they make Joash the king. And so here Joash has grown up in the temple. He's been saved by a priest. But the priest dies later on. And what does Joash do? 2 Chronicles 24, verse 17. But after the death of Jehoiada, the officials of Judah came and bowed down to the king, and the king listened to them. They abandoned the house of the Lord, the God of their fathers, and served the Asherim and the idols. So wrath came upon Judah and Jerusalem for this their guilt. Yet he sent prophets to them to bring them back to the Lord. Though they testified against them, they would not listen. And so here Joash turns his back on the temple. He's turned his back on his hope, his home, his salvation. In 2 Kings chapter 12, verses 17 and 18. Then Hazael, the king of Aram, went up and fought against Gath and captured it. And Hazael set his face to go up to Jerusalem. Jehoash, that's another name for Joash, king of Judah, took all the sacred things that Jehoshaphat and Joram and Ahaziah, his father, kings of Judah, had dedicated, and his own sacred things, and all the gold that was found among the treasures of the house of the Lord and of the king's house, and sent them to Hazael, king of Aram. Then he went away from Jerusalem. He did the exact same thing. He robbed the temple to seek a covenant with man. To find peace, because God can't deliver us. We got to take his gold. We got to take his what's in his house that's valuable. Well, and then in 2 Chronicles 24, verse 20, so remember Jehoiada was the priest that saved Joash. Jehoiada dies. His son, Jehoiada's son, comes in and he says, what you're doing isn't right. Joash, come to reason, it's not right. And so in verse 20 it says, then the Spirit of God came on Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada the priest, and he stood above the people and he said to them, thus God has said, why do you transgress the commandments of the Lord and do not prosper because you have forsaken the Lord? He has also forsaken you. So they conspired against him. And at the command of the king, they stoned him to death in the court of the house of the Lord. Thus Joash the king did not remember the kindness which his father Jehoiada had shown him, but he murdered his son. And as he died, he said, "May the Lord see and avenge." So we have Joash shutting the gates to the temple, robbing from the temple, and murdering a righteous man in the gates of the temple. Oh, how the people of God have looked at God's great house. Now, one of the hard things about the Old Testament is names. So you have Joash, the king of Judah, and then the next generation you have Joash, the king of Israel. They're not the same guy. Different people, same name. But in 2 Chronicles chapter 25, verses 21 through 24, we have this king of Israel, the northern kingdom. They come down and they conquer the southern kingdom. And what do? They loot the temple, of all things. So Joash, king of Israel, went up, and he and Amaziah, king of Judah, faced each other at Beth Shemesh, which belonged to Judah. Judah was defeated by Israel, and they fled each to his tent. Then Joash, king of Israel, captured Amaziah, king of Judah, the son of Joash, the son of Jehoahaz, at Beth Shemesh, and brought him to Jerusalem and tore down the wall of Jerusalem from the gate of Ephraim to the corner gate, 400 cubits. He took all the gold and silver and all the utensils which were found in the house of God with Obed-Edom and the treasures of the king's house, the hostages also, and returned to Samaria. And so here the northern kingdom has no respect for God's house. They come in, they conquer the southern kingdom, they take from the temple. And then you have Uzziah. And Uzziah is described as a good king, but in 2 Chronicles 26, verses 16 through 21, here's this good king who doesn't have proper respect for the temple. He says, "But when he became strong, his heart was so proud that he acted corruptly, and he was unfaithful to the Lord his God, for he entered the temple of the Lord to burn incense on the altar of incense. Then Azariah the priest entered after him, and with him 80 priests of the Lord, valiant men. They opposed Uzziah the king and said to him, 'It is not for you, Uzziah, to burn incense to the Lord, but for the priests, the sons of Aaron, who are consecrated to burn incense. Get out of the sanctuary, for you have been unfaithful and will have no honor from the Lord God.' But Uzziah, with a censer in his hand for burning incense, was enraged. And while he was enraged with the priest, the leprosy broke out on his forehead before the priests in the house of the Lord besides the altar of incense. Azariah, the chief priest, and all the priests looked at him, and behold, he was leprous on his forehead, and they hurried him out of there. And he himself also hastened to get out because the Lord had smitten him. King Uzziah was a leper to the day of his death, and he lived in a separate house, being a leper, for he was cut off from the house of the Lord. And Jotham, his son, was over the king's house judging the people of the land." So we talked about this pattern last week. Only priests were allowed in the temple. Uzziah said, "I want to serve God, and I don't want the middleman." And so he just walks into the temple to serve God, and thus defiles the temple, ignores the pattern, and pays the price. Well, then you have Ahaz, 2 Chronicles 28, verses 16 through 25. "At that time, King Ahaz sent to the king of Assyria for help, for again the Edomites had come and attacked Judah and carried away captives. The Philistines also had invaded the cities of the lowland and of Negev of Judah and had taken Beth Shemesh, Ajalon, Gederoth, and Soko with its villages, Timnah with its villages, and Gimzo with its villages, and they settled there. For the Lord humbled Judah because of Ahaz, king of Israel. For he had brought about a lack of restraint in Judah and was very unfaithful to the Lord. So Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came against him and afflicted him instead of strengthening him. Although Ahaz took a portion out of the house of the Lord and out of the palace of the king and of the princes and gave it to the king of Assyria, it did not help him." Now, in the time of his distress, this same king Ahaz became yet more unfaithful to the Lord, for he sacrificed to the gods of Damascus, which had defeated him, and said, "Because the gods of the kings of Aram helped them, I will sacrifice to them that they may help me." But they became the downfall of him and all Israel. Moreover, when Ahaz gathered together the utensils of the house of God, he cut the utensils of the house of God in pieces. And he closed the doors of the house of the Lord and made altars for himself in every corner of Jerusalem. In every city of Judah he made high places to burn incense to other gods and provoked the Lord, the God of his fathers, to anger. Oh, the logic of Ahaz. He goes in, he robs from the temple to make a treaty, which is against the law, and then says, I don't understand why God's not helping me. Forget it, I'm going to serve other gods. And he, once again, steals from the temple, breaks the things that are in the temple, and starts serving other gods. And then you have Hezekiah. Hezekiah's not a good king. Hezekiah's a great king, right? He's the guy who then comes in and says, whoa, Ahaz went way too far. He did something wrong. We are going to fix the temple. And so Hezekiah comes in as our hero, the guy who comes in and fixes the temple and restores it and gets everybody focused on it again. But in 2 Kings chapter 18, verses 13 through 16. Now in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and seized them. Then Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria at Lachish, saying, I have done wrong. Withdraw from me. Whatever you impose on me, I will bear. So the king of Assyria required of Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. Hezekiah gave him all the silver which was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasuries of the king's house. And at that time, Hezekiah cut off the gold from the doors of the temple of the Lord and from the doorposts which Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid and gave it to the king of Assyria. The great restorer, the great king, stealing from the temple to such a degree that he is chiseling the gold off the doorposts. And then his son, Manasseh, was incredibly wicked. In 2 Chronicles 33, verses 1 through 9, we see his attitude towards the temple. Manasseh was 12 years old when he became king, and he reigned 55 years in Jerusalem. He did evil in the sight of the Lord according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord dispossessed before the sons of Israel. For he rebuilt the high places which Hezekiah his father had broken down. He also erected altars for the Baals and made ashram and worshipped all the hosts of heaven and served them. He built altars in the house of the Lord of which the Lord had said, My name shall be in Jerusalem forever. For he built altars for all the hosts of heaven in the two courts of the house of the Lord. He made his sons pass through the fire in the valley of Ben-Hinnom. And he practiced witchcraft, used divination, practiced sorcery, and dealt with mediums and spiritists. He did much evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him to anger. Then he put the carved image of the idol which he had made in the house of God, of which God had said to David and to Solomon his son, In this house and in Jerusalem, which I have chosen from all the tribes of Israel, I will put my name forever. And I will not again remove the foot of Israel from the land which I have appointed to your fathers, if only they will observe to do all that I have commanded them according to the law, the statutes, and the ordinances given through Moses. Thus Manasseh misled Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem to do more evil than the nations whom the Lord destroyed before the sons of Israel. Takes it and he just makes other idols in the temple. And now if you go on and you read verses 10 through 17, he is punished and he learns his lesson and he comes back and he tries to fix everything, but he can't. He tries to fix the temple, but he can't fix the fact that the people's heart is now not in the right place. And so there are high places. It does mention in verse 17 that they are worshiping in the high places. They're only worshiping God, but the focus isn't on the temple. It's on all the places. And it's supposed to be on God's house. And so God finally has had enough. In 2 Chronicles chapter 36 and verse 7, we see the temple once again looted, but this time not by a king of Israel or a king of Judah. It says, Nebuchadnezzar also brought some of the articles of the house of the Lord to Babylon and put them in his temple at Babylon. Again in verse 10, at the turn of the year, King Nebuchadnezzar sent and brought him to Babylon with the valuable articles of the house of the Lord, and he made his kinsman Zedekiah king over Judah and Jerusalem. So here are two separate occasions. Nebuchadnezzar now has looted the temple, but it is not Nebuchadnezzar at all. Daniel explains this in Daniel chapter 1 and verse 2. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. He points out that this was God's doing. God gave them over. So go back to 2 Chronicles. I appreciate your patience. We come to the end of the book. The last two verses of the book are verses of some hope, of the people being restored from the captivity. But the sad state, verses 15 through 21. The Lord, the God of their fathers, sent word to them again and again by his messengers, because he had compassion on his people and on his dwelling place. But they continually mocked the messengers of God, despised his words, and scoffed at his prophets, until the wrath of the Lord arose against his people, until there was no remedy. Therefore he brought up against them the king of the Chaldeans, who slew their young men with the sword in the house of their sanctuary, and had no compassion on young man or virgin, old man or infirm. He gave them all into his hand, all the articles of the house of God, great and small, and the treasures of the house of the Lord, and the treasuries of the king and of his offices. He brought them all to Babylon. Then they burned the house of God and broke down the wall of Jerusalem, and burned all its fortified buildings with fire and destroyed all its valuable articles. Those who had escaped from the sword he carried away to Babylon, and they were his servants to him and to his son until the rule of the kingdom of Persia, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah until the land had enjoyed its Sabbaths. All the days of desolation it kept Sabbath until 70 years were complete. And that's how the book of 2 Chronicles really comes to an end, with the exception of those two verses of 70 years later, some good news. So when we look at the history of the temple, this great structure, this great hope, this great presence of God, we see it getting robbed, neglected, turned away from, defiled, to where they would murder righteous priests inside it, where they would enter it in an unauthorized way, and where they would even dare to bring idols and put the idols inside and worship other gods in the place where there was to be worship for the one true God. As I said, I appreciate your patience. I know that's a long history lesson, but it is important for you to see again and again and again. This is how God's temple was treated. It actually got me to thinking as I was looking at it. In the New Testament, we see the Jews having such pride in their nationality. They're so proud to be Jews, and it suddenly struck me. Do they even know their history? Do they know what they've done, what their forefathers had done? So why does this matter? Why go through this? Well, 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 11 tells us that the things written in the Old Testament were written for us. All that stuff we just read, it's for us. It's for us to learn from. In Luke 17 verse 32, Jesus does something really simple. He just says, remember Lot's wife. And that's all he needed to do. He just went back to an old history lesson. And he says, remember what happened to Lot's wife. And he's saying, bring application to your life. Why did this happen to them? So that you and I would learn. Why was it written? So that we would learn from their mistakes. So that we would not repeat them. So what's the point? Well, if you look at 1 Corinthians, we have 1 Corinthians chapter 3 read for us this morning, verses 16 and 17. There are many places in the New Testament that talk about us being a temple. You could look at Ephesians chapter 2 or 1 Peter chapter 2. You could look at these passages, and you know what it is? It's encouraging. These passages are about you guys are the temple of God. Do you understand how great that is? Do you understand how important that is? Not so in 1 Corinthians 3. In 1 Corinthians 3, he goes through the implication beyond that. When he says, do you not know that you are a temple of God and that the Spirit of God dwells in you? If any man destroys the temple of God, God will destroy him, for the temple of God is holy, and that is what you are. Is it any wonder that the only place in the New Testament talks about us being a temple in the negative sense is also the book that, if I were to ask you what book in the New Testament talks the most about church problems, I think we would get almost a unanimous answer from people that know this, would be willing to answer. They'd say 1 Corinthians. Coincidence? No, it's learn the lessons of the past. They treated the temple in Jerusalem poorly. Don't you dare treat the temple of God poorly today. Learn the lessons. And so you go through and you think about what's in 1 Corinthians. And we're not going to spend a long time about this, but the old temple was robbed. How would we rob the temple? Well, I suppose some people might actually just rob it, just outright. You know, we have a collection plate coming around, somebody just taking money out of it. You just think about what that compares to. But 2 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 7 is a follow-up to 1 Corinthians 16. 1 Corinthians 16, he says that we're supposed to lay by in store on the first day of every week. In 2 Corinthians 9 and verse 7, he says, each one must do just as he has purposed in his heart, not grudgingly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. I can't tell you how much to give. I only know that we're supposed to give. And you have to decide how much to give. But I want you to think for just a moment what you do. If you purpose in your heart, you say, this is what I'm going to give, and then you don't. What did you just do? Here we have the temple. This is the temple, the church is, and we're not giving what we purposed to do. What about neglect? In Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 25, well, actually, if you start in verse 24, it tells us that we should consider how to stimulate one another to love and good deeds, not forsaking the assembling together as the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as that we see the day drawing near. Brothers and sisters, what are we doing when we choose not to worship together? We are the temple, and we're choosing not to be a part of it. We come together to encourage one another, and we're choosing not to do that. But it's not just whether we show up or not. It's about whether we're strengthening each other, whether we're encouraging each other, whether we're building each other up. 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 22 through 26 is a passage about us being a body. Different term than the temple, but we're all a body, and we all have different parts, and we're supposed to help those who are weak. If somebody is weak and you don't help them, what have you done? How have you respected the temple of God? What about the violence? Ever known a church to divide? I mean, is there anybody in here who's not aware of a church that's divided? The church is the Lord's temple. And that is the main thrust of 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 10. He's begging them, now I exhort you, brethren, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you all agree and that there be no divisions among you, but that you be made complete in the same mind and in the same judgment. He talks about the problems that they had, the divisions that they existed, that they were some saying that they were better than others. He goes on in chapter 3, verses 1 through 4. He says, and I, brethren, could not speak to you as to spiritual men, but as to men of the flesh, as to infants in Christ. I gave you milk to drink, not solid food, for you were not yet able to receive it. Indeed, even now you are not yet able, for you are still fleshly. For since there is jealousy and strife among you, are you not fleshly? Are you not walking like mere men? In chapter 6, he goes on, he talks about lawsuits that were occurring where they were hurting one another. In chapter 8, verses 10 through 13, he talks about just overrunning people's consciences. There are some churches out here. I'm not going to name any particular ones. I actually can't think of one right off the top of my head, and that's just fine. I'm actually pretty good about that. I'm happy about that. But there are churches out there that have just, they are so happy. They think they're accomplishing so much because there were people in their midst that had a conscience problem with something they were going to do, and they just ran over them, kicked them out, got rid of them, and now the church can do whatever they want, and they're growing and they're increasing and they think things are great. They attacked the temple of God. They may be excited, they may be thrilled, Division is awful. Awful. Mistreating one another is awful. When you look back at what was happening in the Old Testament, we do that today when we mistreat one another. When we have jealousy and strife. When we run over other people's conscience and say, I don't care what you believe. I don't care what you think is right. I'm going to do what I want to do. Which has been, unfortunately, far too prevalent in the history of the church. We are attacking the temple of God, and God's message was very clear about that. When you attack this temple, God will destroy it. So there's violence. And then I wonder about idols. And well, clearly, we don't set up an idol to Zeus or anything like that in here. I still wonder about materialism within the church. In 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 14, we're told to flee from idolatry. But in Colossians 3 and verse 5, we're told that greed is idolatry. And so we may not have Zeus and we may not have Baal, but do we have money as our God within the church? Is that really what we're focused on? Because when we have as our life we've set in our heart, money and greed, and then we come into the assembly and we become the church, what have we brought in? We have brought in our idols, and we have not learned our lesson. And have we defiled the church? 1 Corinthians 5, he talks about there were people within that church that were living in a sinful manner. He speaks specifically about a man who is having a sexual relationship with his father's wife, so his stepmother. And he begs them to put a stop to it. He says, your boasting is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump of dough? Clean out the old leaven so that you may be a new lump, just as you are in fact unleavened. For Christ our Passover also has been sacrificed. Therefore let us celebrate the feast, not with old leaven, nor with a leaven of malice and wickedness, but with unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. He's begging them to clean out the sin that existed within them. Brothers and sisters, we are the temple. And as such, we've been sanctified, we've been made holy, and we must not tolerate sinfulness. We must not tolerate sinful attitudes and sinful actions. We must take action. Why? Because we love God's house. Because we love the temple and have learned from the past. Has it been defiled? Well, in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, it describes the worship service. And he says that it should be orderly. He says in verse 33, for God is not a God of confusion, but of peace, as in all the churches of the saints. We're not supposed to have confusion. He says in verse 40, but all things must be done properly and in an orderly manner. And what happened in between there, in verse 34 through 36, is he's told the women they're supposed to be silent in the church. And while we are living in a time in which it's just become assumed that women will rule, that women will have leadership roles within the assembly, we need to understand what that's doing to the temple. Uzziah was a good king, but he had no place in the temple. He wasn't supposed to do what he did. It's not that women are unimportant. It's just this is the way God has made it. And we should learn the lessons of the past and follow God's path and his plan. I encourage you to go back and read 1 Corinthians in light of the temple and in light of the way the temple was treated and as a warning. There's some good news. I present this lesson to you as a warning, not as a rebuke. And I cannot thank God enough for that. Brothers and sisters, I am thankful to be a part of this congregation. I am thankful for the way that we have acted and the way that we have behaved. I am not saying this lesson to say, okay, everybody, get up here and repent right now. I want the whole row full. I'm not saying that. But as much as we may do what's right today, tomorrow we could so easily change. And if we move to other places, we may be part of another congregation that's not doing what's right. And we must understand, we must learn the lesson of the church being the temple of God and us being careful to treat it with the honor and sanctity that it deserves and that God demands. Well, next week, or the week after, I'm not really sure when we're going to get to the next lesson, but the fourth lesson in this, we're going to look at the restoration time period, when the temple is rebuilt and what we can learn from it. But right now, I want you to consider this warning. How do you treat the church? Do you treat it like the temple of God that it has been declared to be? And remember, we're not talking about the building. We're talking about the people. How do you treat it? May we live in such a way that we will not be ashamed. There's nothing we can do about the past and the history. And there's not much we can do about the future. But this is our time and our choice and our decision. And may this be a time period in which God looks, and may this be a location in which God looks and says, here are people who respect and love my house, and thus respect and love my name and who I am. I thank you so much for your patience. I know that I have gone long. I pray that you'll be here this evening as well, this afternoon, when we have a singing and reading night. And I pray that you'll take this message to heart. I know I've had to think about a lot of things. If there are any here who are not Christians, we give you an opportunity to become one, an opportunity to become a part of God's great temple, to be holy and blameless. If you wish to be baptized into Christ, don't wait. Come forward, take a front seat, confess your faith, repent of your sins, and you will be baptized and forgiven this morning. And if you're a Christian and you have fallen away, won't you come back? We stand here not to destroy you, not to discourage you, but to welcome you back and to build you up, because you are a part of the temple too. Let's be holy. Won't you come as we stand and as we sing?
Have your heart that's clear.